You're listening to a Bellingcat Discord server stage talk titled Investigating an Oil Spill with Open Sources. This week, Bellingcat researcher Logan Williams took to the stage and brought along some Discord server guests, Thomas and Lottie. Thomas joined us on stage, but Lottie joined us in the chat. Both Thomas and Lottie worked in the Bellingcat Discord with Logan on a series of investigations surrounding an oil spill off the coast of Tobago. Together with a few others, they figured out the name of the vessel spilling oil, plotted its final movements using satellite imagery, and explored its possible ownership and who could be held responsible for the environmental disaster. In the Discord stage talk, Logan summarizes all three investigations and explains what they did to discover their findings. We also spoke about what it was like building an investigation in the server. You can find links to the research in the description of this podcast. The talk was hosted by me, Charlotte Marr, on Thursday the 7th of March in the Bellingcat Discord server. Hey, welcome back to another Bellingcat Stage Talk. This week, we're discussing environmental reporting using open source research methods. You may have seen on February the 7th, a mystery vessel began leaking oil and ran aground on a reef off the coast of Tobago. Discussions started in this server as to why the vessel wasn't traceable by authorities and who put it there. These discussions became a fully-fledged investigative series, one that has led to a successful partnership with the Trinidad and Tobago Guardian. Today, we're joined by Bellingcat researcher Logan Williams, who has spearheaded the research into the spill. I've also been told he may be joined on stage by some of the investigation's contributors, active Discord members of this server, in the Q&A section of the talk. But first, sit back as Logan explains how the investigation began and what we discovered about the mysterious vessel leaking oil hundreds of miles into the Caribbean Sea. As he talks, please put all your questions in the chat and I'll ask them as we move into the Q&A section. Thanks so much for being here, Logan. Please take the stage.
Thank you, Charlie. Yeah, so this was a really interesting project for me. It was the first project that I'd worked on with people from the Discord server. And I guess I'll just kind of start at the beginning with the first article and explain kind of what we found and how that process went. I'll try not to take too much time going through the articles because I'm sure that folks have some questions and I'm really interested in what kinds of questions you might ask both me and then also the Discord folks that collaborated on it. So as Charlie mentioned, on the morning of February 7th, people in Tobago woke up to oil all over their beaches and a ship lodged on a reef upside down on their island. There was a little initial reporting on it. I didn't actually notice this story until almost a week later, on February 12th, 5 days later, when the first initial dive teams had come back and said that they found a name on the vessel. They found the name Gulfstream while they were diving around the ship. But they had no other information. Because diving, of course, you know, any industrial or marine salvage dive is already a pretty dangerous thing to do. But doing it when there's zero visibility because the water is filled with leaking oil is almost impossible. So it was really hard work for the dive teams. But they found a name. And I started just poking around because ships, you know, have a kind of a lot of information on the internet. There's a lot of records. There's a lot of data. They kind of leave a trail wherever they go. And Gulfstream is a pretty common and generic name, but there were only maybe a dozen or so ships that had the name Gulfstream. So I just started posting some links in the Discord, like, hey, this oil spill is interesting. Here's some Gulfstreams. And the first one that I thought could be it was debunked very quickly, I think, by Lottie. But then we started looking at some of the other ships that had the name Gulfstream. And one of them seemed potentially really interesting. And this was because of something that we discovered in one of the photos of the ship. This was a photo that was taken by someone standing in Tobago just after it washed up, of the bottom of the hull of the ship sticking out of the water. And I believe it was Lottie in the Discord, or maybe Donut, or maybe it was someone else entirely, who noticed that there were these little holes on the side of the ship in kind of a step-by-step ladder pattern. And those are what are called pigeonholes or a pigeonhole ladder. And they're recessed steps that are used by someone that's kind of climbing up the outside of a ship. And you would only ever really climb up the outside of a ship if that ship were a barge that might be unmanned. So there's no one already on the ship. You're pushing it around in a tugboat, and then you need to do something on the ship. So you climb onto the barge. And this was really interesting to us because no one had reported that it was a barge. And barges, because they're unpowered, they don't have a motor or an engine on them, have a different regulatory regime than ships. There's lots of cracks for ships to slip in through as well. But for the most part, if you have a motorized ship of a significant size, you have to comply with certain licensing and certification requirements. That means that that ship leaves a pretty significant paper trail, even if you have it flagged in a country that tries to make as little information public as possible. But for barges, there's no requirement that they do any of that. They're not necessarily being regularly inspected because they don't have an engine to maintain. So it's a lot easier for them to kind of squeak by year after year. And the International Maritime Organization, which assigns kind of one of the only solid pieces of data for linking one ship when it was owned by someone to when it was owned by someone else, they assign what's called an IMO number. They don't assign those to barges. They're only given to powered vessels. So we thought it was kind of interesting that these barges are a way that ships can kind of slip through the cracks. And it also seemed like that might be a possible explanation for why it was so hard for the authorities to find information about the vessel, because they don't have an IMO number printed on the outside of the ship like a conventional motorized ship would. So we looked into this ship, the Gulfstream, and the tugboat that it was attached to, which was called the Marlin, and found a few scattered photos over the past couple of decades. Mostly taken in the United States when it was operating there. But we were able to match some key features on the ship to the picture we had of the capsized vessel. And that kind of made us think we were on the right track. But the night before we published this first article, there was definitely a little bit of doubt still in the Discord and in my head about, could this really confidently be the vessel that we saw? And the main reason I was doubtful was this barge has a really kind of special setup with its tugboat. It's part of what's called an articulated tug and barge system, where the barge is designed with a notch that a specific tugboat, one that was built at the same time the barge was built, kind of fits into that notch and creates a combination tug and barge system that's a little more maneuverable than a conventional barge might be. And this means the back of the ship has this very distinctive kind of notch shape. But the night that we were kind of piecing this all together, my partner actually made a 3D model after I sent her a bunch of diagrams of like, this is the size of the ship. This is what we think it looks like. Do you think you can make a little 3D model of this? And she did. And then I shared that in the Discord, and Thomas was able to take that 3D model and simulate how it might sit in the water and compare that to the aerial photographs we had. And at that point, it matched up perfectly. And that was what we needed to convince ourselves that this was, in fact, the same barge that we had. So then we published the story. And very shortly after, just a few hours after we published, the National Security Administration, or a similar name in Trinidad and Tobago, put out a press release that said that they had identified the ship and that it was, in fact, the same barge that we had found. Though the tugboat Marlin that we were looking at was no longer in the picture, which was news to us and started the process of research into the second article. So the second article, we kind of picked up where we left off, and this was kind of where the Discord collaboration became most intense. We were all in a DM group talking around the clock about new things that we found. But one of the key bits of information that we got from the press release was that the barge had been towed by a tugboat called the Solo Creed that we hadn't found before. And we started looking into the Solo Creed, or Solo Creed, really. And it had some AIS data that let us kind of follow where it had come from. And if we followed where it came from, we found the barge itself that we had been looking at. And this sort of filled in some of the gaps that we had in the barge timeline. We had, when we knew it was the Gulf Stream, but we didn't know about the Solo Creed, we'd lost it at a shipyard in Venezuela. And then a couple years later, it seemed to reappear. But this let us follow how it got from that shipyard in Venezuela to Colon in Panama, and then eventually get picked up by the Solo Creed on its final ill-fated voyage. And some of the stuff that we found on satellite imagery was really interesting, because it basically showed that this barge had been sitting around for first half a year at one port in Colon on a little dock, and then it was moved from that port, and it was literally just kind of rammed up on a beach, on this muddy beach behind a row of warehouses just outside of Colon. And it sat there for 7 months or so, which was really interesting because it seemed like a very informal place for a ship to be stored.
Yeah,
to put it gently. We kind of got deep into satellite imagery and just finding all of the places that we could see this ship. And tanker trackers as well, which is a company that tracks oil tanker movements, especially in the Middle East, for people in the industry to kind of know how oil shipments are moving around or understand the status of certain business deals in the Middle East, also picked up on it and identified satellite imagery that showed that this ship and its barge had been in Venezuela, which is really interesting because, of course, Venezuela in recent years has been both a huge oil exporter, as well as, I should mention, a fuel importer at times as well, because their refinery capacity has been pretty limited. And then we also followed it around and found a bunch more images, including an image that says that, or that showed that it seemed to already be leaking a few days after it had left Venezuela. And another image that we found that showed it seemingly soon after it had capsized, where you just see this massive oil slick in the water and what is clearly the bottom of the ship for the first time in the satellite imagery. So that kind of put together a really interesting story for the ship's last voyage, which was part of the second article, where we show it going from this like impromptu DIY dock in Colon to Venezuela, and then eventually capsized and leaking oil in the middle of the sea. The other thing that we discovered in the article was that the ship, when it was before it had come to Colon, served as a tanker for this interesting company called Sea Energy Group that had owned a few ships. And Sea Energy Group, we didn't look into them in too much detail because they were the previous owner. There was nothing directly linking them. But there were some interesting connections that we found to some of the other companies involved that would come up again in the third article. And we also found a interesting court injunction that was filed by the United States against Sea Energy Group because they were suspected of violating Venezuelan sanctions by transporting Venezuelan oil. Lottie, I think, I'm pretty sure it was Lottie, noticed a Google Street View image in Colon that showed us the name of the ship, which was really interesting because we were still going as though it was named Gulfstream. But the Google Street View image that was found showed that the name was Sea Marlin, which is what led us to the Sea Energy Group discovery. And then finally, we were starting to look into the ownership question more recently. And the Solo CRADE had some interesting open source evidence online. Most notably, there was a photo taken of the tugboat and uploaded to marine traffic on December 24th, 2023, which would have been about a week before it left Cologne and went on its final voyage. And this image was tagged with the name of a company, Mélage Offshore Corporation, which we'll get to in the third article, and was clearly taken in Cologne. We geolocated it just to be sure. And this, to me, was a really interesting lead because we'd already started looking into Mélage a little bit, and it was linked to not just the Solo CRADE and Gulfstream, but another one of the ships that had previously been owned by Sea Energy Group. And we also found some links between Mélage and the dock where the Gulfstream had been docked at before it was moved to the informal beach. So there was a lot that we kind of were already poking around in this second article. But we really kind of focused this on the story of the barge and what we knew about how it had gotten to Cologne and then how its final voyage went from satellite imagery. And then that brings us to the most recent investigation. And this one, we also decided that we really wanted to partner with a local investigative journalist in the region who could both help us bring the story to a more local audience, and then also was a really critical part of the reporting. We worked with Asha Javid, who's the investigations lead for the Trinidad and Tobago Guardian, and she was great at helping us follow up on these local connections, get on the phones with people, knowing people in Guyana that we would have never, you know, been able to get the phone number of, and so on. So the third story is mostly about Mélage and following up on this loose end of, wait, why is there a photo taken of this ship just a few days before it left with the name of this interesting Panamanian company? So we dove into that more. What we found was that Mélage was actually linked to about six different companies that seem to have interlinked directors that are all family members of one particular person who has quite an online footprint. Of course, just because, you know, someone's name pops up over and over again in news articles isn't enough to, you know, actually prove anything, but sometimes it does tell you you're on the right track. So when we started looking up this person, Augustine Jackson, and found that he had been involved in a 2016 very dramatic oil import deal that went wrong and resulted in multiple court injunctions and a ship full of sailors that was stuck in the middle of a river for months, we thought that was really interesting history with this person. And Mélage itself was named in 2019 because it had become a partner of PDVSA, the petroleum company in Venezuela, just after the United States put sanctions on oil. And I should say, because this has been something that has confused me and has confused lots of people, when the US puts sanctions on oil, of course, the United States can't set sanctions policies for other countries. They're just saying we want or we're not going to allow any American company to transport products or send money or exchange goods with this country or these companies. But because petroleum sales globally are mostly in US dollars, a whole lot of the petroleum industry has to go through the US banking industry at some point. And the US banking industry will say, oh, if you're suspected of violating sanctions in any way, you can't do business here. So that's a big problem for a lot of companies, even if they have nothing otherwise to do with the United States. So when the United States sanctioned Venezuela in 2019, it caused a lot of problems, and Venezuela had to scramble to find other companies that were still willing to take its oil. And one of them that they found was Milage Offshore Corporation, again, the same company that posted this image onto marine traffic. We also looked at all of the other ships that we could find that were connected to Augustine Jackson and found that a lot of them had similar patterns of seemingly being based out of Cologne and visiting Caribbean ports, turning off their AIS transceiver for a long period of time, potentially doing ship-to-ship transfers, and so on. And this is kind of where things got a little crazy in this story. So we found a certificate of registry that was obtained by the Guardian and Bellingcat from Zanzibar, the Tanzanian ship registry that the ship was associated with, that also seemed to name Milage. It named one of the directors of Milage. And we sent that to the Zanzibar Maritime Authority to ask for more information. And what we got back was an email that said, this is actually a fraudulent certificate of registration. Here's the real one. And the real one also had the name of the Milage director on it. So at this point, we were like, okay, it's weird, first off, that this certificate was apparently fraudulent, but they didn't change the name of the person that owned the ship. And more importantly, this means we're on the right track. This is a validated ship registration certificate that has the name of Milage on it. We were able to find some contact information for Augustine Jackson. And Asha and my editor at the time, Sean, got in touch with Augustine and started asking him some questions. Unsurprisingly, he wasn't super happy to talk to us and pretty much immediately said, I don't own that ship. I have nothing to do with it. It's owned by someone else. And we were like, well, who's it owned by? Give us their contact information. And eventually he did, gave us the contact information of this person, Dr. Abraham, and then blocked all communication on WhatsApp where we'd been talking with him. So then we started talking with this Dr. Abraham person who had a lot to say. He was very talkative, helpfully, and sent us a lot of things that didn't make too much sense. So a lot of the article is kind of going through the evidence that was provided and looking for ways to verify that with open source data, or more accurately, ways to debunk it with open source data. So for instance, he sent a bill of sale document that claims that he had purchased this ship, this barge, while it was in Panama. And the document claims that he purchased it for $350,000, which is kind of interesting because we had found Panamanian court records from just a few months previously that said that the total amount that the owner got for the sale of the ship was $7,500. So either he really got ripped off by buying it for $350,000 or something else is happening. What else did we find here? We asked him why he had stopped transmitting AIS data during the ship and why it chose not to broadcast its location. And his response was, quote, I choose what to do with my property, unquote. Now, needless to say, you don't actually get to be the sole decider of what you do with your property when you're operating a ship that's sailing between international ports. And I believe that in this case, ceasing transmission of AIS data without a justifiable reason is a violation of some international maritime organization standard. He also offered contradictory information about where the ship was registered and who it was registered in the ownership of. that we compared to information we received from the Zanzibar Maritime Authority, and that didn't add up. For instance, there was a certificate that was issued on February 13th that said that the owner was a company in Guyana. And when we asked Ola Lakin, Dr. Abraham, about this, he said that he had no business in Guyana. And, you know, clearly that's a contradiction with the ownership of the vessel that he's claiming to own. Perhaps I think the most shocking part of this conversation was when Asha was talking with him. And he said, you know, I don't understand why people are asking so many questions about this boat. And Asha said, well, you know, people are curious about the boat. And he responded, but why? And Asha said, why? Well, because no one has claimed it. And his response was, such incident is not new. Certain things are inevitable. Which again is, needless to say, a pretty shocking reaction to something that seems to have been a preventable accident with a poorly maintained vessel. And then the other thing that we were really trying to understand was, when did he tell the authorities about this incident, if at all? He claimed that he'd provided information to Trinidad and Tobago within 72 hours. He didn't send us any evidence of that, and we haven't been able to verify it. But the Guardian received a letter from the Trinidad and Tobago Ministry, from the Trinidad and Tobago Maritime Authority, that they had received from this Dr. Abraham on the 15th of February, 2024, that from the wording in the letter, though again, we haven't verified this, seems to be the first contact that the Maritime Authorities got from this supposed owner. And it's notably the 15th of February would have been one day after the name of the vessel and the name of the tugboat was made public. And in this letter, which was published, I should add, before we published any of our satellite imagery showing that we had kind of the complete route of the Solo Crate and the Gulf Stream mapped out, in this letter, he describes picking up the barge in Aruba, which we can tell in satellite imagery did not happen, and claims that it was going to Guyana en route to Nigeria. He also makes some, you know, interesting claims that there is nothing that they could do to stop the barge from sinking, but didn't acknowledge why he had waited 10 days at all. Needless to say, again, if a ship that you're responsible for is sinking, it's a hazard pretty much immediately. It's going to cause environmental issues. It's going to cause navigational issues. It's really important to not wait 10 days. And yet every indication is that's what happened. And then the last part of this article, and then we'll move into Q&A, is, or there's two parts, actually. Well, briefly, I should say, one of the things that we found was there had been a tender awarded for the transport of oil to Guyana Power and Light, the electric utility in Guyana. And there has been a document published by news organizations in Tobago that seemed to show that the Gulf Stream was headed to Guyana Power and Light. So we looked into some of the connections there and found that this small company that had been awarded the tender, she was seemingly very well connected in Guyana politics. And that there were also some links between Jackson and some Guyanese oil importers, including one person named Dorwayne Bess, who was found guilty last year in another oil import scandal in Guyana. And then finally, we found some court records I mentioned earlier about the sale. These court records also have some really compelling descriptions of the barge, where the filer of the lawsuit, the owner of the dock that the barge had been abandoned at, wrote about how the barge had water leaks that were so severe that it had to constantly be pumped out in order to prevent it from sinking, and that it was in quite a state of ill repair. And again, after it had been sold in this court auction, it was seemingly just moved to a beach and not in a place where it could have undergone comprehensive maintenance or anything that might be necessary to make it truly seaworthy. So that's a summary of the three articles. It was a lot in 3 weeks, and really none of it would have happened without the work of folks in the Discord, the work of my former editor, and kind of the enthusiasm the Discord folks in the Discord had for diving into this issue when I first posted some thoughts about it. So yeah, I'm very excited to look at any questions and also to welcome the other folks that worked on the story with me.
Thank you so much, Logan. I hope you've had some sleep over the past 3 weeks, because the work you guys have done on this is incredible. And I bet it required a few late nights as well. But Lottie, Thomas, and Donut, if you do want to speak on stage, please request now. You can request by putting your hand up, and I'll see your request come up in front of me. Everybody else, please put your questions in the chat. I also wanted to note, while the others try to join us if they want to, that it was announced today, I believe, that the oil spill has actually stopped spilling into the Caribbean Sea, which is really nice news. 3 weeks, or like almost a month, over a month after it initially spread, which is really good.
That reminds me of something that I should shout out here, because this is one of my favorite pieces of impact from this story. I think the collaborators know this, but maybe not. Right after we published the first article that had the photos of the ship when it was in the United States, people that worked on the ship in the United States started emailing us, including someone that still had blueprints from when he was the chief engineer on the ship. And we were able to talk to the folks in Trinidad and Tobago working on the salvage and environmental recovery parts of the project, and send them these blueprints and technical information about the ship, which they didn't have. And that was only something that was possible to do because we were able to publish this first article with folks from the Discord.
Thanks so much for noting that. Thomas has joined us, which is great. Hi, Thomas.
Hello.
No problem, Lottie. Lottie says, I'll leave Thomas and Donut to speak. I'm too shy. It's absolutely fine. Don't worry. You'll be the person in the chat running the show. Galen, one of our fellow staff members, has asked, this feels like the type of investigation where you would touch on a huge number of potential leads. How did you prioritize what to focus on? And relatedly, what were the best aha moments of the investigation?
Great question. There were lots of different leads, and especially when you're dealing with kind of financial investigations or looking into corporate business networks or shell companies, there's so many people and names and things that it can be hard to keep track of. I have an enormous crazy string diagram that kind of links out all of these that was helpful for sorting it out. I think in terms of prioritization, this is where I think open source investigation methods can really work well with more traditional journalism. For instance, there were people that Asha or us talked to who knew things about the official investigation, but weren't willing to go on the record about them or weren't willing to, you know, provide actual documents or that kind of thing. But just knowing, okay, this person suggested that this might be a good place to keep looking, and then looking into open source documents that could provide further evidence in that direction was really helpful. So I think that, yeah, traditional journalism definitely still has a role to play within open source based methodologies.
Thomas, what was your most aha moment during the investigation?
Probably right after we published a second article, we found this series of mishaps that happened in January and February 2019, where in the space of about a month, there was a time where it disconnected from the tug that was pushing it. I think at that time it was the Marlin, and went missing at sea for 7 days before washing up in Colombia and getting beached there. And then about a month later, the same thing started to happen during a storm. It had navigational issues and again had to be rescued by the Coast Guard of Colombia. Just kind of an insane series of mishaps happening to this one barge that kind of highlights all the things that we're seeing about the unregulation or the lack of regulation going on here.
Sorry, go ahead, Logan.
I was just going to say, I didn't even mention the 2019 incidents. There's just so much to this story. Yeah.
This barge has been through a lot. Subtle Knife asks, what was your most unexpected source of information? I mean, you mentioned that you found the name Sea Marlin via Google Street View imagery. What was your most unexpected source of information?
Yeah, I think the Street View imagery was probably takes the cake for being kind of the most surprising and definitive thing. Something else that was interesting is a lot of these ship brokers that we found that are selling these sketchy old ships operate on Facebook. So we saw lots of interesting Facebook groups that were kind of helpful for building out the network of how these companies work. Thomas found lots of information, especially about the companies, too. So maybe he has a different answer.
I mean, for me, it's hands down that Street View image, too, for the most surprising source. But it was also just kind of the shock that we had when we found those Panamanian court documents that said, oh, this ship was leaking and had to be constantly pumped out to keep it afloat in dock months before. Milaj took it out to sea and decided to put $2 million of oil into it. So just the mismanagement and lack of regard at every step is just unbelievable.
Yeah, I think that comes through so clearly. Social media was surprisingly useful for this. You know, a lot of these companies have almost nothing about the ships that they own. They're like very careful that all the ships have their own shell company that can't be linked to the parent company. And then the parent company has a LinkedIn where they post posts that are like, look at our ships, here's a photo of them.
And that's not even to mention that a lot of the ships that we connected to Augustine Jackson and Milaj were named after his family members who were also serving as the directors of Milaj and its associated companies.
Amazing links that you guys have made. For anybody listening who hasn't got knowledge of kind of ship and ship tracking, you mentioned that the AIS signals were turned off. Is that usual for ships of this nature? Is it an average practice, or was that a surprising thing that hampered tracking this ship's movements?
So yes and no. It's not an acceptable standard operating procedure for ships to turn their AIS off, unless there's kind of a few legitimate exceptions to that. If you're having technical issues with your ship, or if you're somewhere where it might be dangerous to broadcast your location. So I believe you see this now in the Red Sea, where sometimes ships will legitimately turn off their AIS to make it more difficult for Houthis or for Somali pirates to find them. But you also see lots of illegitimate dark AIS use, and it's quite common, particularly around sanctions or places that are trying to export despite sanctions. We've seen it in previous work that Bellingcat has published about Russian grain exports from Ukraine. And you also see it pretty commonly in Venezuelan traffic.
I am just linking that Russian ship tracking piece in the chat now. I was about to say something that we focused really heavily on when we were tracking Russia's operation of grain smuggling out of occupied Crimea territories. JK asks, how difficult was it to balance which pieces of information to share back with the public in the Environment Wildlife channel on Discord and what to keep in the inner circle, Auri, your DM group? How did you kind of decide what goes in the public Discord and how much collaboration can you have in this server?
That's a good question. And I, again, this was one of my first projects working intensively with the Discord, so I don't know that I have a perfect handle on it yet either. Initially, everything was just in the Environment Wildlife channel. And basically, until we published the first article, everything was being discussed in the open there. And I think that that worked really well at the beginning because I didn't know who might be interested in the topic. I didn't even know that there was kind of as much depth to it as there turned out to be. And it was still relatively simple at that stage. Like, we were just trying to find the identity of this ship. Someone who hadn't been following could jump in and kind of get up to speed quickly. By a few days later, it had become such a like tangled mess of different things that it was really difficult for anyone new to jump in. And at that point, we were mostly talking in DMs. I did want to share more in the Environment Wildlife channel, but never really ended up sharing much more than what we published. Some of that was out of, you know, trying to keep what we had found under wraps until we were ready to publish it. Some of it was also just time. It's really difficult to, you know, if I was going to summarize the research and share it back to the main channel, I might as well be writing the article, which I was also doing at the time. But yeah, I have mixed feelings about this because I think it would have been nice for more to be shared back throughout the whole process, because that really was the genesis of this. If it hadn't happened in the public channel, if I hadn't posted in the public channel, the stories wouldn't have happened.
And Thomas, how did you find working on this series of investigations with the Bellingcat staff?
Oh, I've greatly enjoyed it. It's gotten to see, it's allowed me to see so much of like how y'all work internally, but even without being involved in one of these investigations, you can see all of our work for that first article and a huge amount of it for the second article, just in the Environment and Wildlife channel. If you just scroll back through, you can see we're finding these things. We're identifying, oh, here's a photo post of it. Oh, here's a Sentinel-2 image of it. And it's really amazing to get to see how things are clicking and coming together. So I'm really glad to have been a part of it. Thanks.
Lottie's putting in the chat, especially once it got to name individuals, did it become an issue in sharing that information in the group? And it was such a mess, that conspiracy connections meme mess, that we had to keep updating a summary Google document. The PDF file got to like 150 megabytes or something ridiculous.
I think it was like 60 pages long, 60 pages. Mostly thanks to Lottie for putting that together. But a satellite image of the ship almost like every single day for 2 years or something wild.
Wow, that's amazing. I love that you went to that level of detail. What's the reaction been like actually in Trinidad and Tobago? Has anything further been announced? Has the government over there spoken to any of the research?
The government's been very quiet. The most recent publication got some more attention there because it was, of course, in a local newspaper. And there were some questions that were asked of the Prime Minister in Parliament yesterday and during the PM's questions that they have. they essentially offered no information and said that they weren't ready to talk about the ownership of the vessel until they were confident in exactly who it was and presumably the next steps to take, which I'm not a maritime lawyer or a legal expert of any kind, but I think that there are definitely some complications that they might be facing. Identifying the owner is not necessarily super helpful for finding the financially responsible party, which could be buried under several layers of insurance and other companies. So this isn't the end. I mean, we found someone that seems to have been, or two people that seem to have been directly connected, including one person that's directly claimed that they own the vessel. But the authorities certainly have more work to do in terms of figuring out how to bring whoever is financially responsible to pay up. I also think the politics of it might be kind of complicated there, because this is now an issue that connects Guyana and Venezuela that have a very long-running border dispute. It connects Venezuela and several countries that are closely aligned with the United States, including Panama, which uses the U.S. dollar, for instance. So I think it's, yeah, I would suspect the authorities will be a little quiet for some time, but we'll see.
Swim Two Birds asks, really good to see on-the-ground journalists becoming involved. What was your process on deciding who to partner with? And just before you answer that, I just want to remind people we've got about 10 minutes left. So if you want to get your questions in, get them into the chat now.
Yeah, I agree. It was also, this was one of my first projects working with journalists or starting a collaboration with other journalists on the ground, and it added a lot to the investigation. Our process was fairly straightforward. We asked a few people that had been working on the investigation, are there any local journalists that you know who are keen to work on this? And then Asha's name came up. The Guardian is the paper of record for Trinidad and Tobago, so it's kind of a good place to work with. And we had a meeting, and it was a pretty easy collaboration.
JK has been asking a couple of questions. Is there anything you would do differently next time? Any lessons learned that might be helpful to others? I also wanted to ask if you saw some of the tools that you used for this investigation, whether they'd have any applications for any other environmental reporting, for example, fires, deforestation, anything that would be useful for environmental reporters in general to be aware of.
On the second question, there are maybe some tools that could be useful. I think a lot of environmental issues have similar questions of opaque company ownership and similar difficulty finding the ultimately responsible person. Or, you know, if that ultimately responsible entity doesn't actually exist, which is often the case in really complicated things, finding out how to describe the chain of responsibility that led to something happening. And I think some of what we did with tracing out the company networks and such could be applicable skills. Hard to consolidate that into like one transferable thing, but there's definitely some overlap. As for lessons that might be helpful to others or helpful for future reporting, I think initially, one of the things that we wanted to do with the second article was to make it bigger and incorporate more of what made it into the third article eventually. But it actually turned out to be really helpful to publish these as kind of smaller pieces one after another, because each one led to more people on the internet, more open source researchers, more other organizations, finding new things, sharing those, and then we could build off of that and make the future work even better. So I think my big takeaway from this is share what you're working on publicly as soon as you can, because it lets you go way farther, even if you're sharing a smaller story than what you initially set out to do.
Thomas, anything you would add on to that? What lessons did you learn from this particular investigation?
I mean, it's the same thing for me. Every single time we published, tons of people came out of the woodwork. More documents found their way online. So genuinely, if you're starting a project, just go ahead and put something out about it, be it on the Discord, be it somewhere else. But when Logan put his thing out, immediately there were people jumping on it. And that's how this all started and snowballed from there. And if you don't put something out, people aren't going to be able to know what you're working on, help.
And what was it like working on a new region? JK's just asked, how does it feel to have your work be this important to people, even if it is a niche topic on the global scale, in regards to many local people really grateful for your work? And I believe that this is a new region, really. I know we've done work on Venezuela and Guyana before, but we've not really looked at Trinidad and Tobago as a country before. What was it like working on an area of the world that you might not have visited before as well, Logan and Thomas?
Yeah, so the first part of that question, it is nice to work on something that is clearly directly important to other people. I do a lot of work on the tech team that is sometimes writing long technical guides and things like that. And those are definitely not as satisfying as publishing something and then seeing a comment on Facebook or a reply to the Bellingcat Twitter account that says, like, I'm from Trinidad and Tobago. It's so nice to see international media cover this. Thank you for your work. That it feels great to have had that impact, even if there's still a lot more to do on this story. And then in terms of researching a place I haven't been to, I think that's just so nice. I'm the kind of person that can spend like an hour just like zooming in and out on places on Google Maps. Though I feel like I know some of the place names around Guyana and around Trinidad and Tobago better than my own home at this point.
I think it also highlights so much the importance of working with local journalists too, with this research, like Asha. 75% or so of the third story we wouldn't have gotten without her. So even though open source research is incredibly powerful and can be used to access areas that you've never even been to, it's still really important to have someone on the ground in many cases who can help you with this and discover all new angles that you would never have known because you've never been somewhere.
Yeah, as I mentioned in the chat, it's the beauty of open source, right? Being able to help areas further away. It's really, really actually nice to see in the audience that we have quite a few people from Trinidad and Tobago. Libby, for example, has just put, yes, I'm from Trinidad. And it's amazing to see the work being done around this issue. So thank you so much for joining. Cecil Nye says, mental note, don't challenge Logan to GeoGuessr. A really common game that we play here at Bellingcat and in the server, which is really fun. Lastly, you mentioned, you kind of half mentioned it, but what would be your next steps on this investigation if you were to take it any further? And what might you encourage other people in the Discord to dive into in the environmental channel if they're interested in taking part in research on this or independently doing research on this any further? And that question's to both Thomas and Logan.
Yeah, there's definitely still some leads that we have hanging from the first few articles that we're looking into. Right now, I think what's been really nice to see and what I'm kind of taking an opportunity to wait and see what happens is that there's lots of local journalists in Guyana, in Trinidad and Tobago, who are taking the information that we've put out there, following along with our work and finding places where they can find new leads or find new documents. So we've already heard from some journalists working in Guyana that have found some interesting things. And I'm hoping that that leads to more local reporting, especially the kind of local accountability reporting that's hard for us to do from across the world, but where a newspaper that's based in a city that knows people, that can call folks on the phone, hold them to account, can potentially really make a difference. So we'll see what happens, but I'm excited for the work that local journalists are doing at this stage.
And there's still tons of open source leads too. I won't mention all of them, but one of the biggest ones is, where's the Solo Creed now? After the, we think it was, I think the night of the 5th or morning of the 6th that the Gulfstream capsized, it left the scene with AIS off. So finding the Solo Creed is a big part that's still missing.
And in general, I'd say if, you know, the idea of tracking down a ship like this is exciting to you, there's a lot happening in the world that's worth looking at. Not only oil shipping, but fishing is a huge issue. And websites like Global Fishing Watch are this brilliant source of open source information about how fishing fleets operate, including if they're fishing in places that they shouldn't be, or potential human rights issues with employment on fishing boats. And there's also, you know, of course, a lot happening in the Red Sea right now with another ship that was recently sunk that is also posing a huge environmental crisis. So there's a lot to look at with ships and the environment.
There you go. You heard it here first. You've got lots to look into. And if you're interested in diving into the ship tracking, you can look at the Ships and Planes channel in the Discord or the environmental space. Both of those are really active channels in this Discord server. Jake has just mentioned that Asha Javid is in here. Thank you so much for joining, Asha. It's great to see you here. And we absolutely loved your version of the article as well in The Guardian, which I linked earlier in the chat, and I'll also include in the podcast link as well. But I think that's a good note to end it on, leaving them with the mystery of the disappearing Solo Creed, which I believe we had a little bit of video from the crew as well in our latest investigation, or what appeared to be the crew anyway, which could be a starting point. But that's just a little clue for anybody who wants to dive deeper. Thank you so much, Logan, for explaining all three articles today and for doing this incredible work. And thank you, Thomas, for jumping in and speaking about your experience from the Discord member and contributor point of view. Thank you, Lottie, as well, in the chat for adding amazing links and everything like that. I will leave the chat open, but we'll end the stage talk here. And thank you, everybody, for joining. Thank you for listening to the Stage Talk. If you'd like to catch a Stage Talk live where you can ask the guest questions, join the Bellingcat Discord server by visiting www.discord.gg/Bellingcat. The music you've heard is titled Dawn by Newer Self and is courtesy of Artlist.